Third, inconsequential facts. Facts which are immaterial to the lawsuit, but supply the continuous narrative flow that a lawyer may want the jury to have. Example, the law may tell you that the events of Monday and Wednesday are material. Tuesday is not material. But the jury knows that Tuesday comes between Monday and Wednesday. So if you want to go through time continuously, it's Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. How do you do it? Well, let's see. Sir, have you now told us everything about Tuesday? Yes. Did you get up as usual? I'm sorry. Sir, have you now told us everything about Monday? Yes. Did you get up as usual Tuesday morning about 7 a.m.? Yes. At work by 9? Yes, sir. Work all day? Yes. Home at 5:30? That's right. Watch a little television? Yes, sir. Have a couple of beers? Yep. Have dinner? Yep. In bed by 10? Yep. You get up Wednesday morning? Yes. Is that when something happened? Yes. Tell the jury what happened. You've taken them right through Tuesday. The jury gets the impression of a continuum of time, and it's not dull. It's not standing still. It's not lagging behind. It has the kind of impetus that you want it to have. Next exception. You may choose to leave out Tuesday. Monday and Wednesday are what's material, so you're going to go from Monday to Wednesday. How do you go to Wednesday? Lead them there. You may leave when you are going to a new topic, and the best way to do it is unmistakably. Sir, have you told us everything about Monday? Yes. I now take you to Wednesday morning, about 10 a.m., at the intersection of Main and Market Street here in town. Were you there? Yes. Did something happen? Yes. Tell the jury what happened. The next exception, it's just the order in which I list them. You really cannot anticipate, so it does not figure in the preparation and execution of an effective direct examination. The cases talk here of a hostile witness, but they use that term to cover several different situations. I prefer not to speak of a hostile witness, but rather of a boorish witness, a witness whose behavior is obnoxious on the witness stand. If it is direct examination, you may now interrogate by leading questions. But since, unless you're setting this up, and that would be unethical, you can't anticipate this kind of situation, let's just leave it at that. If a witness acts up in this manner, that's just unanticipated. Sixth exception. The cases also here speak of a hostile witness, but it's very different. This can be anticipated, hence you may make use of it deliberately in order to justify your asking leading questions on direct. A predisposed witness, that's my terminology. Predisposed, a witness whose position in the world is such as to make it likely that he's predisposed against you. It's direct examination. The law of evidence says you may therefore ask leading questions. I say you must. The craft of advocacy would say you probably should ask leading questions. Example, sir, you saw the two cars collide, didn't you? Yes. Now, you're aware that I'm the lawyer for the driver of the yellow Plymouth. That's right. And we're suing the driver of the blue Buick. I know that. Now, you know the driver of the blue Buick, don't you? Certainly. How do you know him? He's my brother. That's a predisposed witness. He's not a boor, but he's probably going to be against you, so you may interrogate by leading questions. Do so. Seventh, obviously a special instance of the predisposed witness is the adversary himself. In a civil case, it's not uncommon for the defendant to call the plaintiff calls the defendant. If it's the adversary himself, you may interrogate by leading questions. I encourage you to do so. Next, sometimes can be anticipated. The reluctant witness, a witness who is not a boor, who's not predisposed, who is not the adversary party, but who for whatever reason simply seems reluctant to testify. To use a homely expression, it's like pulling teeth. You are permitted by the law of evidence to ask leading questions. I urge you to do so. Next, always to be anticipated, the witness has a limited capacity to speak, can speak well enough to be competent, but not so well that it's anything other than painful to get the direct out of him. Use leading questions. And finally, you can't anticipate this. It's accidental when it happens. The witness forgets because of the pressure of the occasion. You may use not total interrogation by leading questions, but one or two leading questions for the limited purpose of refreshing recollection. Which brings us pretty much on schedule to objections. I know you're looking at the clock and saying, how can it be on schedule? No, 20 or 25 minutes to go. As a matter of personal privilege, the lecturer always gets 5 or 10 minutes to run over, but I promise you it won't be longer than that. I assure you we're on schedule. Be patient and trust me and you will see. Okay? Objections. It's important to discuss objections because they are not sufficiently discussed. They're an important aspect of trial technique, and for whatever reason, people who enjoy talking about trial practice seem to ignore it. You may be full of fear that under the guise of discussing objections, I'm going to rehearse all of the law of evidence, because after all, the law of evidence underlies the making of objections. No, have no such fear. As a matter of fact, if anybody in the room thinks that you make an objection whenever the other side does something that violates some rule of evidence, please disabuse yourself of that notion. That the other side has violated some rule of evidence is a wholly insufficient reason to make an objection. After all, you are not in court to vindicate the law of evidence. The law of evidence is not your client. That the other guy did something wrong, so what? All of us do things wrong all the time. One of the reasons you will be astonished at how quietly and quickly a trial between good trial lawyers goes is that there are very few objections, because a good trial lawyer knows that you make an objection not because the other side did something wrong, but because the other side did something wrong and it's what comes after the and that's most important. It hurts you. And if it doesn't hurt you, who cares? Don't object. If it does hurt you, then of course you make an objection. And really, when you think about it, most of the time what the other side does doesn't hurt you. Now, granted, he's trying to win his case and you're trying to win your case. In that sense, everything hurts you, but that I mean the harpoon really goes in. No, very few things involve that. Now, with that preface, let us look at the technique of making objections. There are, you may recall vaguely from law school, two types of objections. They've been around for a long time, and they're with us still. The general objection and the specific objection. A general objection is an objection which, however it may be made, does not indicate to the judge the ground upon which the objection is made. Okay? I object. That's a general objection. Objection! That's a general objection. Or as I usually used to have to make them, DAH! It's a general objection, too. Okay? It tells the judge that you're objecting, but it doesn't indicate the ground. Now, a specific objection does, in however artless a manner, tell the judge the ground of the objection. So, I object to your sake. Specific. Objection, opinion. Specific. Bah, leading. Specific. The law, in its well-nigh limitless wisdom, prefers specific objections to general. And if you don't believe that, take a look at Federal Evidence Rule 103, which says, in essence, you must make a specific objection. If you make merely a general objection, aberration or marginal cases aside, it's as if you had made no objection at all. That is not to say that from the viewpoint of a working trial lawyer, which is the viewpoint we share, a general objection has no utility. A general objection can still be very useful. Example. The other guy did something wrong, and boy, the harpoon is in, 18 inches. God, it hurts. Let's object, and we know the ground of the objection. Objection! Now, what you want to do is say, objection, take a breath, and state the ground of the objection, right? But it plays itself out this way. Objection! Sustain! The judge said sustained before you had a chance to give him the ground of the objection. What do you do now? You know what you do. Shut up. Sit down. Not another word. If you ever try to give the judge the ground of the objection after he has ruled your way, the judge will take it as you are telling him that he did something right. And because judges don't like to be told by you, the lawyer, that they did something right, and because all judges think that they have a kind of elfin sense of humor, what the judge will do is take it away so that it's going to sound like this. Objection! Sustained! Right, Judge, that's hearsay. Oh, on that ground, overruled. Next. Every lawyer knows that after a while, you develop a litigator's ear. I don't mean it's deformed. I mean it's like the musician's ear. The law of evidence is such a contraption, nobody can carry it in his mind all the time. It's kind of stored away in the memory core of the computer between your ears, and you have an ear for it. You know, your ear tells you, as a musician's ear tells him there's a discord, the other guy has done something wrong. I don't quite know the name of it, but I know he's done something wrong, and boy, it hurts. The harpoon is in. What you need is a couple of seconds to think, so as to figure out the ground of the objection in order to be able to make a specific objection. Well, you know how to get the couple of seconds? You all know. Make a general objection. When the judge invites you, directs you actually, to turn it into a specific objection, you do so. But it takes a couple of seconds. And a couple of seconds in here is a very long time. You can pull the rule, the ground of the objection, out of that memory core so that it'll sound something like, your ear tells you it's wrong. The harpoon is in. Objection! On what ground, counselor? Oh, Your Honor, we all... It's hearsay. Right, sustained. Now, because, as I've said before, I'm a practical fella talking to practical men and women, what do you do when this happens? Your ear tells you it's wrong. The harpoon is in. I need a couple of seconds to think about it. Objection! On what ground? Didn't work. I didn't know then. I don't know now. The memory core spun. Nothing came out. And there is the judge looking at me. Counselor, didn't you hear me? What's the ground of your objection? What do you do now? Well, happens to all of us. One possibility. Deal with the judge the way you would deal with the jury. Tell him the truth. It's amazing what it'll sometimes do for you. He did something wrong. Harpoon is in. Objection! On what ground? Your Honor, I don't know. Well, I do. Sustain. It can have that effect, but only once in the course of a trial. Suppose you've used it once, and it happens again. It'll happen to everybody. Objection! On what ground? I don't. No. Now, what am I going to do? It's kind of forbidden knowledge. It's not going to go outside the family, of course. But every trial lawyer finds himself or herself in that spot. And what you must have is a set of locutions, things to say to the judge in response to his question, things which sound like the ground of an objection, but really aren't. And if you say it with enough passion, it's amazing how you can carry the judge with you. Now, I'm going to give you just one example because this is just too precious, and you've got to get up your own examples. If need be, steal them from other lawyers. You hang around courtrooms, you'll hear it. Such as, objection! On the ground, Your Honor, he can't do that! Right, sustain. And so on and so on. Now, what can you do with an objection? What are the purposes to be achieved by an objection? And this is not procedure. We know you preserve it for appeal, et cetera, et cetera. I think the classically stated, the orthodox things you can do with an objection are there in the literature, in the pamphlet. It gives the trial judge a chance to get it right. You preserve it for appeal. It's what permits a common law trial to be adversarial. Let me talk about four other purposes, getting right down to brass tacks. First, remember a little bit earlier I talked about Nastassi stuff, making the motion to dismiss on the other lawyer's opening statement just to shake him up. There is a situation that all of us from time to time must deal with. I wish to address technique, how to execute it. So I put to one side ethics, whether this is the kind of thing you will permit yourself to do. You don't get disbarred for this stuff. It's entirely a matter of what kind of lawyer are you? You know, litigation like basketball is in theory not a body contact sport. But even though the guys don't want to engage in body contact, when you put 10 giants on a fairly small court and have them running at 30 miles an hour down that court and tell them to stop under the basket, there are going to be elbows and knees. There's just no way to avoid it. Well, some of that is at work here. Let us assume that you're sitting there and the other guy is summing up. And this is an important case. And you've done a good job, but he's done a superb job. And that summation obviously has the jury hypnotized. He's got those 6 or 12 jurors right there in the palm of his hand. He's bouncing them around, and in a moment he's going to open the window and throw them right out of the courtroom, taking your case with them. What are you going to do? Sit there and let it happen? Well, maybe so. That's for you to decide. Or are you going to interrupt? Because he's done something wrong? No. But because you want to interrupt to break the spell, to prevent him from keeping up the rhythm, which for the most part is what carries the jury with him. You're going to make an objection, in short, for Nastassi purposes. And for God's sakes, if you're going to do it, it's your ethical decision whether to do it. If you're going to do it, I say, though, as someone interested in technique, do it so that it works. Do not, as so many people do, lack the courage of your convictions. If you're going to do it, for God's sakes, kill him. You know the old saying, if you're going to shoot at a king, you must kill him. It does no good to say, objection. No, that doesn't interrupt. It's not objection, sustained. He won't miss a beat. What you've got to do is make a speech. You make a speech as loudly and as vigorously as you can. And what you say doesn't matter. Because you're not objecting to get a ruling, you're objecting to break the other guy up. So, it's objection, Your Honor, didn't we learn in law school? I know I learned in law school. I'm sure Your Honor learned in law school. Didn't you, Mr. Smith? Didn't you learn in law school? And on you go. Doesn't matter what you're saying. Until the judge says, what are you talking about? Will you shut up? Sit down. Whatever it is you're saying, it's overruled. And that's the time to say, thank you, Your Honor, and sit down. And the other guy turns back to the jury, and what does he say? And you know what he says. He says, where was I? And that's exactly what you wanted him to say. Many of you regard that as hitting below the belt. Maybe it is. Many of you will want to say to me, I don't think I'd ever do that. More likely, it's going to be done to me. What can I do to guard against it? And there's something to be said on that subject. I've learned it from people in the theater who cannot explain why it works, but it works much of the time. Not always, but much of the time. And you know when theater people use it? When somebody in the audience gets sick, faints. On occasion, somebody in the audience dies right there of a heart attack. And a really professional theater person, an actor or actress with professional pride, will try to hold the audience. That's what they mean. Hold the audience so that the play perhaps will pause, but you can continue right where you left off, even though they've carted somebody off on a stretcher. There are some extraordinary theatrical anecdotes on that, but we don't have time. This is what you would do, just taking advantage of what the actors have learned. And don't ask me why it's going to work, but it probably will work. You're addressing the jury, and you've got them hypnotized. They're in the palm of your hand. The other lawyer jumps up and starts to rant and rave. First, the instant he starts to talk, freeze. Literally like that, if that's where you were. Don't move. Second, it's implicit in what I've said, but I've got to make it explicit. Wherever your eyes were at the moment of interruption, keep them there. If you were looking at juror number 7, keep your eyes on juror number 7. Next, do not respond. In my ranting and raving, did you hear me say, Mr. Smith, didn't you learn in law school? Yeah, that's to get him to yell at me, to get him to say, this is an outrage, I protest this, I'm going to the Bar Association with you. At that point, I know I've done what I wanted to do. The instant I sucker him into saying something like that. Don't respond, or say anything in response. And finally, after the judge sits him down, do not in any form acknowledge the interruption. Don't say, where was I? Don't say, before I was interrupted in so outrageous a manner. Don't acknowledge that anything has happened. Just pick up where you left off. Not necessarily with the next word. You probably don't remember the exact next word. You know where you pick up? At the same emotional level. That's what's important. And somehow, it's usually there. You've still got it. You've held the jury with your body and with your eyes and by not acknowledging that there's been an interruption. Good stuff. You can make an objection next to talk to the judge. And you know the circumstance in which you want to talk to the judge? Something like this. You made the motion in limine to get the advance ruling on whether he's going to allow the guy to say, well, I didn't see the light, but my wife cried out, the light is red. It's now almost 5 o'clock in the afternoon. The carbon dioxide level is approaching the lethal. The judge had lunch, a couple of glasses full, and I don't mean to suggest that the judge is asleep. Of course not. The judge is never asleep on the bench. Why don't we just say that the judge is not cooking on the one cylinder God gave him, okay? Now, the you know the case. The judge doesn't know the case, just as the jury doesn't know the case. The witness is on the stand who, in three questions, will be asked the crucial question. You know it, the other side knows it, but the judge does not know it. You know, the questioning seems to be perfectly simple and straightforward. Did you get into the car? Yes. Anybody get in with you? Yes. Who is that? My wife. Did you start up? Now, in a couple of seconds, we're going to be at that question. What color was the light? Answer, I didn't see it, but my wife cried out, my God, the light is red. You know that the judge will give you a perfectly fair ruling, right down the middle. You just don't know what the ruling's going to be. So be it. At a minimum, though, you want the sequence to be, what color was the light? Objection, maybe, sustained. Not, what color was the light? Objection. My wife said it was red. Sustained. Because the judge wasn't on top of it. See, the judge was kind of slow in responding to the situation. What you've got to do is get the judge to pay attention. And the way you do it is to make an objection. Not for a ruling, but to alert the judge to what's happening. And in most jurisdictions, I think there are formulae for doing it. In New York, state and federal, this is the formula. Did you get into the car? Yes. Did you get into the car with somebody? Yes. Who is that? My wife. Objection, Your Honor. We're on dangerous ground here. What ruling is the judge supposed to give you? I'll tell you what ruling he will give you. The ruling will be, thank you, counselor. Because what that is a tactful way of saying, pay attention, judge. This is that crucial stuff that we discussed in the motion in limine. We know you're going to give it to us right down the middle, but be on top of it so that the ruling can come on the beat instead of after the answer, when it's kind of not very easy to deal with. There are the other two purposes I will just mention and leave to the materials. You can sometimes make an objection in circumstances I regard as perfectly ethical for the purpose of signaling something to the witness. For example, the witness has begun to testify to things he sincerely believes to be true, but did not himself observe. You make an objection, really for the witness. Objection, Your Honor, the witness is not telling us what he himself saw. He's telling us what he believes to be true based upon what he saw. The ruling is unimportant. You want the witness to hear that, to put him back on the track. I see nothing unethical about that. And finally, I know it's done. You will never do it, I will never do it, because I can't conceive of a situation in which it's ethical. That is making an objection for the purpose of talking to the jury, when what you're telling the jury is something they are not entitled to know. Now cross-examination. At this hour, cross-examination? Yes, because we have found in presenting this program many times that all I can say about cross-examination is this. You will, I know, forgive what will seem to be the immodesty of it, but it's the only way I can tell you what needs to be said. My views on cross-examination are fairly well known in that it's a separate lecture which, properly done, takes 2.5 hours. It's a half a day all by itself. And that lecture is fairly widely known because it's on videotape, and the videotape is shown around law schools and bar associations. I dare say that many of you have seen that videotape. If you have seen it, I now incorporate it by reference. If you have not seen it, I hope you will see it someday. Maybe someday I'll get to do it, to talk about it live, because it's a wonderful subject. But I am not depriving you of anything worth knowing, because the entire content of that talk on the Ten Commandments of cross-examination is in the printed material. What is omitted are the jokes and the ha-has and things of that kind, which are pretty good, if I do say so, but still, we just don't have the time, because that would have used up half of the day. So we've now done cross-examination. Much of what I had to say, would have to say, were time unlimited, is simply a repetition of what's in the book. When you have a chance, look at what's in the book. There are two things I want to talk about specially in connection with summations, and then we will be done. First, see infra, the way in which you use the request to charge in a case that turns on facts, evidence, not on law. You use the request to charge as an aid to your summation. The other aspect of request to charge. In every jurisdiction in the land, state or federal, you are permitted to submit written requests to charge. Their function as permitting you to participate in formulating the legal issues in the case we discussed earlier. Let's assume you've got a case that turns exclusively on the evidence. You know that the judge, to one extent or another, is obliged to marshal the proof. That's the term you will find in the appellate opinions, to marshal the proof. By and large, federal judges have a heavier burden than do state judges, but all judges must, to some extent at least, marshal the proof, which means summarize for the jury the factual contentions of the parties. Summarize for the jury the testimony that the witnesses have given them. And third, show the jury, in an even-handed manner, of course, how the witnesses' testimony relates to the factual contentions of the parties. What you should do in a case that turns on the facts is draft the judge's charge from beginning to end, as you would like him to deliver it. You draft it as an advocate, of course, but also as an officer of the court. His charge on the facts, marshaling the proof. Cut it up into a number of requests to charge, that's usually the way you do it, and submit those requests to the judge. These are requests not on theories of liability, simply requests on how to marshal the proof. It's perfectly proper to submit such requests because that's an important part of the judge's charge. The reason to do so is a little-known provision of the procedural statute. I have not looked up Minnesota's, but I know it's there. In the federal court, it would be Rule 51 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, and its equivalent exists in every state, so you can take a look at it for yourself. 51 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. And you know what that says? And your Minnesota statute will say the same thing. If requests to charge are submitted, the judge must, underline must, give you his rulings before you sum up. And if the judge forgets, remind him. It's mandatory. You are entitled to the rulings before summation. Now, you know what the rulings are. The judge can say, granted, I will read this to the jury. The judge can say, granted in substance, I don't like this language, but I'll give this idea to the jury. Or the judge can say, denied, I will not give this to the jury. And if you ask in a nice way, the judge will usually tell you what he is going to give to the jury on that point. Now, you know what to do with it? You use it yourself. If you think the situation warrants it, in exactly the words the judge will use. You see, he's locked in. He can't change his rulings. The idea of Rule 51 of the civil rules and the equivalent state provision is to give you that opportunity. You know, when you play a record, when you hear the sound that's going to be on the next groove, they call it pre-echo. That's what you're doing. You pre-echo the judge. And do you see why? As you talk to the jury, and it's perfectly fair, you will not get the objection that you're discussing law, because you're not. You're discussing the facts. Perfectly proper. As you talk to the jury does not know that you're pre-echoing the judge. Of course not. They haven't heard the charge yet. You know that you're pre-echoing the judge, but the jury does not. The jury remembers everything. 15 minutes after you sit down, they hear the judge telling them exactly the same thing, maybe even in the same words. And you know what they say? Remember, the judge is the ultimate authority figure. They say to themselves, boy, that's a smart lawyer. The judge sees things just the same way the lawyer does, which means that you have associated the judge's status with you. And even at that last stage of the trial, you work on building up your position with the jury. Second thing I want to say, it's touched upon in the materials but not developed adequately because I think about it rather a lot, to the extent that I think about anything. A question that will seem for a couple of seconds unrelated to summation, but I think it's intimately related to summation. The question is, Why in heaven's name has the common law trial worked as well as it has? You know, the institution of the common law trial has been around for 7 or 8 centuries. And if it's been around for 7 or 8 centuries, it must work pretty well to the satisfaction of the community of customers. It is not immediately obvious to common sense or intuition why it should work so well. It's kind of a Rube Goldberg contraption. In its essence, you take highly trained professionals, we lawyers, you put them together with people who are selected precisely because they are anything but highly trained professionals, the jurors, and somehow it works. No other system has anything like that, but it works for us. Why? I have a speculation as to why it works, and I think this surmise or speculation illuminates the kind of argument you should try to make in summation to a jury. It occurs to me that we lawyers and they jurors are complementary. We make a perfect unity, and maybe even it's synergistic, that the whole is more than the sum of the parts. And maybe here's why. We lawyers, by reason of training, inclination, outlook, we lawyers are historians. We always look to the past. What's the first question you ask the client? What happened? And on the basis of what happened, we'll figure out how to handle this trial. We're also professionals. You try a case today, you try another case tomorrow, and another case the day after that. We tend not to pay very much attention to what is perhaps the most important fact about the trial, and that is, when it's over, the litigants go home. There is no next day's trial for them. They must go home and try to resume their lives. We tend to forget that because we look to the past, and once the trial is over, we look to the next case and the segment of the past involved in that case. Jurors do not share our professional outlook. I have a feeling that jurors, precisely because they are laymen, look in a direction different from the direction we lawyers look. They know that when the trial is over, the jurors go home. They also know that since the past cannot be changed, it is ultimately trivial. More important is the future, because you can affect the future. And I think what jurors ask themselves when they come to decide a case is not what happened, but rather what ought to happen. What is the appropriate last paragraph of the story we're writing right now? And when they try to answer that question, what ought to happen, it's essentially what's best for the future, given that these people must go home and live their lives, or these businessmen must return to the business community. What can we jurors do to make the future as satisfactory as it can be? And that applies in a criminal case as well. I think jurors are profoundly moved by the question, what's best for the future? Lock this guy up for good or not lock him up, etc., and are less concerned with what really happened here. And there's an overlap, to be sure, but there's a great difference. If there's anything to that, you see why the system works. We're not doing the same things. We're doing complementary things. We lawyers look to the past, the jurors look to the future, and somehow it all comes together. If there's anything to this surmise, do you see what it tells you about the kinds of arguments to make to a jury in summation? You must do it delicately, because if you do it harshly, they will have the feeling that you're intruding upon their turf, and they'll resist you. But you all know how to speak delicately and suggestively to a jury. Delicately and suggestively, orient them to the future. You direct their attention to the kind of last paragraph that they might write, which will help these litigants return to their lives. But at the same time, you speak as an advocate, and you suggest the kind of resolution that is best for your client. If there's anything to that, and I'm inclined to think maybe there is something to it, it illuminates something that for the most part we do in the dark. How do we fashion arguments that are likely to move jurors, lay people, as opposed to arguments that will move a judge who share our professional outlook? Well, on that point, I've got to sit down, ladies and gentlemen, not because I want to, and not because I've said everything I have to say, but because it's time to go home. Thank you so much for being so patient tonight.